Fire Engineering Podcasts are sponsored by MSA. Firefighters want to be connected to each other, to dispatch, and to their commanders. MSA has created Lunar, a wireless, handheld device that includes thermal imaging, firefighter ranging, motion alarm, and cloud technology with GPS. It's part of the new connected firefighter platform from MSA. Learn more at msafire.com.
Another one, plate 3, engine 2, ladder 1, squad 3, medic 211, chief 6, battalion 3, air truck, rescue trailer, delta response, building collapse, 601 Providence Road South, University Village Apartment, Apartment 707, City Fire Jurisdiction, crossroads of Turner Avenue and Stewart Road, timeout 446, KGJ 485, WQSL 552.
Control to you, engine 3, you're on the scene. We got a single story, single family. We got a detached garage fully involved in the back. We're going to be stretching a line to the water supply in the back of the front.
Battalion 2 is on scene in Silver Command. We got a good fire with a forcible entry problem. We also got a critical exposure to the south. Gonna need help with the first line and an exposure line. Keely's in charge.
Engine 4, 5, 11. Engine 2 for the fast team. Truck 6, 1. Rescue 1, car 1, ALS 1. Delta response. 24 Country Club Drive, Hilltop Apartment, Building 23. For a structure fire. Front Street, Tag 5.
Engine 4 to fire alarm. Got a working fire. Got about a quarter of the building fully engulfed.
Working fire. A quarter of the building fully engulfed.
Mikey, that's a new building in the construction.
Yeah, it's the other side, Chief. I'm going to be at the rear of the building, fire red. I'm advancing an engine 3/4 line.
Is the building vacant, Mike?
If this is an occupied building, people are still evacuating the building right now.
On your street, in your city, across the country, and around the world. Taking it to the streets is all about fireground leadership and advancing operational excellence on today's demanding fireground. With straightforward street-level talk, with intelligent, stimulating, and provocative insights and dynamic discussion, and interactive dialogue with leading national and international fire service leaders and guests on important issues affecting the American Fire Service with applications internationally within the tradition and brotherhood of the fire service. So, grab a cup of coffee and sit down for this edition of Buildings on Fires, Taking It to the Streets. And now, here's your host, Christopher Now.
Welcome to this edition of Buildings on Fires, Taking It to the Streets, on your street, in your city, across the country, and around the world. Taking It to the Streets is a monthly radio talk show on fireengineering.com, Blog Talk Radio, and I'm your host, Christopher Naum. As always, a heartfelt welcome to our dedicated and loyal program listeners, and to you, our ever-expanding following of our newest live listeners, and those of you that are downloading and listening to our program on your e-media devices. Taking to the Streets is all about advancing operational excellence and decisive engagement with the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussions dedicated to the art and science of firefighting and the traditions of the fire service. So again, welcome to this edition. Our program on this episode of Taking to the Streets is talking about some insights dealing with row house fires and specifically addressing some of the more recent publications and information that's coming out through NIOSH, in particular the most recent NIOSH report that was issued out earlier this year in 2020. We'll focus in on that and talk a little bit further about that. But again, we'll talk about some lessons and learnings that are coming out of a number of events that have occurred over the last number of years. In addition, we will talk about a recent a reference document that our good friends at NIOSH have put out regarding some insights on row house firefighting and tactics. But again, many of us, many of you as listeners, are experiencing some challenges out there. Certainly these are bread and butter operations. We'll get into the weeds on that. We'll also talk about some high-level issues dealing with recommendations, some insights that have come out of the NIOSH reports and studies after action reviews, and then talk about some of our collective experiences from around the country. We have a nice, very well-rounded cadre of guests here on our episode that has that's consistent with our program quality programming, timely topics, thought-provoking insights, and some good discussion and dialogue, just like being around the kitchen table at the firehouse. And again, I want to encourage you, the live listeners that are out there tuning in right now, to please take advantage of our live setting and call in. We'll monitor the switchboard here. The call-in number is area code 760-454-8852. And again, please take advantage of that. I know that I've had some contact with a few of you out there that are listening in via social media over the course of the day today, and I would encourage you to please call in and get into the conversation, because it's all about our collective learnings and insights to help some of our brothers and sisters that are out there that may not have the same level of insight that we're certainly bringing to the table here on this particular podcast, but also may lack some of the insights, especially when we talk about the focus on building instruction and operational issues, of which they are so paramount. And you'll identify how important that is when we talk about the North Colorado Street event, as well as another event that occurred in Delaware. So enough about all of those details. Let me welcome our guests here. I've got Captain Mike Lupino out of Chicagoland. I've got Chief Doug Klein out of South Carolina. And I've got a new addition to our podcast here, and that's Fire Instructor Bud Henkels out of Philadelphia. Bud, I want to welcome you here to the group. The rest of our guys, they'll pipe in a minute, but certainly Bud is a new guy here. I certainly want to welcome you to our conversation. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much.
So why don't you give our listeners just a quick little insight on your background here.
Sure. Let's see. I guess my baptism in fire began way back in about 1976, 77. I used to live in Michigan, in and around Detroit, and I went to school out there. I went from fourth grade all the way up through college. Got my degree in fire science from Henry Ford College out there. But I'm from Philadelphia, and I did apply to Detroit. I did make it in. But, you know, I just wanted to move back home here to Philadelphia. Got involved with the local volunteer department. But I did get enrolled in a structured four-year apprenticeship with the state of Pennsylvania construction. And it's about 8,000 hours of on-the-job training and classroom time. And then I followed up with a lot of continuing education courses on building construction. And then I was approached. I started doing my teaching about 25 years ago. I'm an instructor for Montgomery County Fire Training Academy, which is in Southeast PA. I also teach independently, which I do quite a bit of. For the last 6 years, I've been teaching in the Philadelphia Fire Department. And so this story tonight is really close to my heart, because I knew Matt personally, who was killed. I just recently opened up another site on Facebook. It's called The Wood Frame World Around Us. And it's everything that I have learned in 41 years in the building trades and in the fire service to bring you kind of a comprehensive page that just great discussions with different subjects. Staying ahead of the curve is paramount with everything that's out today. You really have to stay on top of it. So, but I'm delighted to join you guys tonight with my insight, and looking forward to it. And thanks again, Chris. Appreciate it.
You're certainly welcome, bud. Thank you very much. Mike, hey, welcome back again. You and I had some conversations today, but again, Mike Lapina out of the Chicagoland area. It's always a pleasure, and thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule, Mike, to advance the knowledge of construction issues and focus in on some of the topics here today. So, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
And my good colleague and brother out of the South Carolina, again, Doug, it's always a pleasure to have you on as we share our lessons and learnings out of our combined, 50, 40, 80, 90 years worth of fire service experience, right?
Absolutely. It's always good to be able to have conversations and share, and that's what our programs are about, is giving to the men and women who are on the streets so that they have all the tools and the knowledge that we can possibly share with them so that they're able to do the job more effective and efficiently and be able to go home.
There's no question about that. So I want to do a quick shout-out to one of our other brothers out there, and we'll just use his first name again. Mike may be listening, and Mike, you know who you are. Actually, I'll just say this so he'll know who I'm talking to. So Deconis, Mike. And again, based upon what Bud just talked about coming out of the Detroit area, Mike, I'm going to challenge you to give us a call in here at some point as we get into some dialogue and discussions, and lend us some of your insights from the Detroit row house areas of operations back in the old school days. So we'll just leave it at that. So again, let's get right to the topic and the subject matter here. We've got a full schedule in front of us, and again, I'm encouraging any of you that are listening in, please take advantage of doing the call-in as we get into our discussions here tonight, 760-454-8852. So our insights, again, this topic came about as a result of just looking at some of the continuing issues that are affecting the job, and primarily more so relative not only to the old-school issues of the classical row house fires that many of our municipalities experience daily, bread and butter operations, but what got us thinking about the construction issues and some of the other elements, and then tying that back into the more recent NIOSH reports, was a recent publication, as well as some of the information that's now floating and connecting on social media as a result of one very small document that NIOSH put out. It's NIOSH publication number 2020-117. And this is titled Row House Firefighting Tactics. It's just primarily a two-page document with some very brief levels of insight on some operational issues, some insights on features, construction items, a little bit of info, as well as some connection of some resources, of which three of the four NIOSH reports that we'll be talking about here tonight are included in there. So they make reference back to the UL Firefighter Safety Research Institute, primarily focusing in on some of the lessons and learnings that are emerging out of the basement firefighting activities, and we'll talk about why that is connected so implicitly with what we're talking about here. So some of the events that we're going to be discussing and revolving around when we talk about row house firefighting, fires, basement conditions, floor collapses and compromises, as well as other compromises within the structure. These are inherent characteristics of row houses, whether we talk about perimeter wall collapses on those perimeter walls that are not tied into either a party or to a bearing wall, normally the infill of the front or rear of the structure, but also the internal collapse mechanisms that are so common to buildings of type 3 construction within our row house settings. So that was one of the connect the dots. We are making reference to that, but then also as a result of the information on that NIOSH document, we're going to focus in on some of the broad-based lessons and learnings out of four specific reports that deal with both recent as well as some not-so-recent incidences that have occurred in row house fires. We're going to be discussing NIOSH report F as in Frank 2008-03. Again, this was an incident that occurred in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on January 6th of 2018, in which Lieutenant Matthew Letourneau of Engine Company 45 lost his life while conducting operations in a row house fire in which there was a catastrophic floor collapse internally. And we'll connect that dot, and I'll have Bud talk a little bit more about Matt and some of the insights on that report. Secondly, we're going to discuss NIOSH report F as in Frank 2016-18. This was an incident that occurred on September 24th of 2016, in which an arson fire ended up killing three firefighters and injuring four others due to a floor collapse, again, in a row house setting. This occurred in Wilmington, Delaware. That resulted in the loss of life of three firefighters, two at the scene, Lieutenant Christopher Leach, as well as senior firefighter Jerry Fix. And then we have a third firefighter, senior firefighter Ardith Hope, who died on December of 2016 as a result of her injuries that were sustained at that fire. So a triple line of duty death in Wilmington, Delaware. And then rounding out the other two, we have report, NIOSH report F-2014-25, and that was of an incident that occurred on December 9th, 2014, again in the city of Philadelphia. And this resulted in the line of duty death of a firefighter EMT firefighter Joyce Craig Lewis, who was an 11-year veteran and, again, died in the line of duty as a result of being trapped within the basement area of the residence. And then lastly, NIOSH report F-2014-24. Incident occurred on November 12th, 2014 in the city of Baltimore, and this resulted in the line of duty death of Lieutenant James Beath, who was a 62-year-old firefighter serving in the capacity of a shift safety officer, who died as a result of falling through a hole within the floor of a vacant row house. So four specific events, all of which have some very, very clear lessons and learnings that we'll get into here as we progress into our program. But clearly the first and foremost was the incident that occurred within the city of Philadelphia on North Colorado Street on the early morning hours of January 6th, 2018, and again, this resulted in the loss of life of Lieutenant Matthew Letourneau, age 42. He served as a lieutenant on Engine Company 45 that morning, but he has led quite an exemplary life in so many different ways, and it's everything that any one of us would certainly try to epitomize. But he was a student of the job, and it was everything on and off the job. And one of the connections here, when we made reference back to the NIOSH insight document for row house information and features and tactics, goes back to the UL Firefighter Safety Research Institute and their continuing work on basement fires. And again, Matt was very, very actively involved as a representative of the Philadelphia Fire Department, involved with both ISFSI, the UL folks, to provide lessons and learnings and insights, support the activities, the research and development. So, and again, that even extended into the employment of emerging tactics that are part of today's fire realm. When we talk about taking information from R&D and applying it, again, those insights were employed on the morning of January 6th, when he utilized variety of options available to his company, based upon the fact that they had reports of a civilian possibly trapped in a developing fire in this row house. So, Bud, again, I'll prompt you into this. Bud Henkels was a very, very close friend of Matt. I just want to afford Bud just to give our listeners some insights as to who Matt was.
Yeah, Matt was just, I met Matt, Chris, probably about probably about 6 years ago, you know, and we actually met at a benefit. This is what Matt was all about. It was a benefit for an organization called Red Paws, which is a animal rescue at fire scenes here in Philadelphia. I was introduced by a good friend of mine. Her name is Linda Long. She became the first female battalion chief in the city of Philadelphia. She was a captain at the time. She says, I have to have you meet this guy, Matt. He is just like you when it comes to training and his props and this and that. And we just hit it off. I mean, he was a fireman's fireman, and you know, he was going places, and he really believed in the way I teach with a lot of props and visual aids and all that. And I followed him up through the ranks through different firehouses that I visited. He was always pushing my program, pushing. And it was just a tremendous loss. I mean, he was a volunteer before he in Delaware County, Springfield, before he got on the job with Philly. And he never forgot his volunteer roots, which was really great about Matt. Like you said, he was heavily involved in UL's research's work. In fact, I was privileged enough to spend some time with Matt helping the guys out from UL. I was actually Matt's backup man for some of the evolutions that UL put on. And there's a picture of me standing with Matt. I think it's the most famous picture out there, which I donated to social media the day I heard that he was, in the morning that I found out that he was killed. Matt was just a great guy. He was he had a thirst for learning. I know he was going places, and people just, you know, followed him like the Pied Piper. He perished doing what he loved to do. Of course, we were all shocked because of somebody that is so much into the job and has such a passion for it, and that makes it even harder when someone like that passes away. We just scratch our head, and unfortunately, the day of Matt's passing, I do believe this was true. It was his last day at Engine 45. He was being transferred out. I believe he's being transferred to Engine 44, which is not quite as busy, as active as 45's is, but that's where he wanted to be. Wherever the action was, man, that's where Matt wanted to be. So that's Matt Letourneau. He would cheer you up when you're in your worst mood. Matt's own personal edge was getting down on the floor with a toothbrush and scrubbing around the toilet. You know, that was just, he was just a heck of a guy, Chris. Just, I can't say enough about my good friend. And I know everybody who could be listening would say the same thing about Matt. Yeah.
That's certainly the case. And I learned much about Matt through my involvement with the Philadelphia Fire Department, through my activities involved both in the development of
sure.
the NIOSH report, as well as the activities with the Philadelphia Fire Department and the committee that was put together that did the after-action report. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So, again, I want to dedicate this program in memory of Captain Matt Letourneau. And actually all of the
right.
firefighters that we're talking about here tonight, but explicitly focusing in on Matthew Letourneau as a result of his contribution extensively, that was the trigger for the continuing learnings, things that we're focusing in on this episode, as well as some other episodes that we're going to do, but also, again, the refocusing in on a bread-and-butter building type, a bread-and-butter
mm-hmm.
occupancy, that for many of our listeners, this is what you are all dealing with day in and day out with a high degree of frequency in some of our metro areas. Certainly when we talk about Philadelphia, I'll give you some quick stats and numbers here because, again, I was very in-depthly involved in some of this, but there has been estimated the number being over 400,000 row house type structures within the Philadelphia proper. Just under 100,000 with less than 1,000 square feet, upwards of 250 to 275,000 within the 1,000 to 1,500 square foot range, another 50 to 100,000 within the 15 to 2,000 square foot range, and then a lesser degree, a number I don't have the specifics, with greater than 2,000. So we're going to talk about those elements here, and I'm going to open up this line of questioning to each of you. And I'll start off with Mike, with you. So why are we talking about row houses? What are some of the key issues when we talk about a row house that a guy new to the job or a newly minted fire officer should be refocusing in on? Just some key elements on row houses.
Yeah, well, as I was telling you earlier today, Chris, certainly you guys out on the East Coast have a lot more dealings with the traditional row house that everybody's familiar with in the Philadelphia, Baltimore areas. What we have here mainly in the Midwest are townhouses that are 6 to 8 units long, similar, but not in the sense that it's a whole block long. So as long as it's confined to a couple units, it's similar in that respect. But mostly what we're looking for, just like if we're talking about a strip mall fire, we're looking for, obviously, the unit that's on fire, but also fire spread to the adjoining unit. And more common for us is fire spread up into the attic space and moving horizontally across through, openings that are left in the attic space. Even if there's a party wall, those are usually breached in some way. So just trying to convey that it's not just the unit that's on fire, but also the horizontal spread in those.
What would your message be regarding the Type 3 construction issues? What are some of the characteristics our listeners should be tuning in, focusing in from that standpoint?
Well, sure. As far as Type 3, we're looking at fires traveling up through pipe chases. Again, the same thing through either a common wall or a party wall with adjoining units. Watching that fire spread, say, from a basement up through the pipe chases, whether it's via actual fire spread or being conducted up through piping up into the, recognizing these void spaces in these areas where fire can travel, and to pinpoint, especially during overhaul, to make sure that we haven't had fire spread in those areas.
So really, when we get into this discussion, and certainly from our experience standpoint, row houses characteristically, again, Type 3 construction, brick and joist, very common based upon the early days in which these was just a common building type, common construction and materials type, and was very indigenous of what you typically would find in the growing cities along the East Coast. And then obviously as the development of our cities into the Midwest all the way to the West Coast, it was just a common construction type, construction feature, and the characteristics that we are all discussing and trying to paint this picture on. But again, it is bread and butter operations. We talk about old school operations in these types, and I think as we get into the final stages of our conversation here, when we start talking about the emerging trends, we'll talk about, and especially again, everyone's got this experience, what are we seeing with the newer type of emerging row houses, because they are evolving and changing, and especially being very, very familiar with some of the things going on both in Boston and Baltimore, the metro, New York City, tri-state area, and most certainly the studies and the activities that I've been involved with in Philly, just seeing what suddenly, as you turn the corner, and Bud, you can pipe in on this, you can turn down any particular typical grid street in Philly, whether it be in Fishtown or Kensington and so forth, and you see the traditional mid to late 1800s, early 1900s row houses, and then suddenly in the middle of them or at the end or as a result of taking their place, what do we end up seeing as far as the newer type of row houses?
Well, to tell you the truth, a little bit of history of the row houses here in Philadelphia. We have row houses that date back 300 years. And you were going through your list, and as the buildings were getting smaller in footprint as far as square footage, the smaller the footprint, the older the house. We have some here that date back to 1680 or so, or close to it. And the reason why we have so many is due to the fact that it all has to do with, believe it or not, Benjamin Franklin. He was actually witnessed the burning of London. And when he came back here to the city of Philadelphia, he flat out said, there will be no wood frame structures built here in the city of Philadelphia. So that's why we have so many, brick row houses as we know today. To identify them, I've done a little bit of my homework since I was born and kind of raised here, and I spend a lot of time here. The older style row houses are identified by the type of brick. I'm sure you've heard of Flemish bond and English bond, which almost kind of dates the building so you know what you're walking into. And as far as the older ones, they were kind of nicknamed a mill. They were called a Milltown Row between 1840 and 1880 due to the fact of all the carpet mills we had here, lace mills, tons and tons of manufacturing right here in the city of Philadelphia. And then, they started to evolve into the later style, which were, they grew in size, like you said, 16 by 45, two-story. They call them MORs, middle of the row, or EORs, end of the row. But they're basically about what you said, Chris, wall-to-wall framing, party walls between the two. But what we're finding today in my research and what I teach is it's not the same row that all these guys have been walking into 25 years ago. The introduction of lightweight materials in the renovation of these have given builders unlimited use of space without the need of a interrupting bearing wall. I mean, they can virtually, span across 16 feet unsupported, 45 feet in depth. So the guys today, like I try to teach them, be careful. There's nothing outside. They don't participate in the placard program. It is in their computer. It's in their CAD as far as the dates, what they suspect, a lightweight wood frame would be. But I'm talking to something that you've been staring at for 25 years, but you don't know what's going on inside. It's taking on a whole different, attitude inside, and it becomes extremely dangerous, obviously, as you know. But yeah, the brick rows, they're everywhere. They're in my local, some vary from city to city, Baltimore, New York, Philly, whatever, but they're all basically about the same. A lot of times, the framing in them is pretty much undersized for the actual load. The loads were probably fine back in 1920, but today, obviously, it's a lot more, and the framing has never been updated. So that's where we're finding, a lot of problems with all this.
One of the emerging issues that we'll touch upon, again, toward the end of our conversation is just the fact that we are seeing a variety of different new construction, predominantly with engineered structural components, that are taking the place of many of the row houses within the block-long areas in many jurisdictions, certainly on East Coast, and it's certainly taking place all the way into the Chicagoland, St. Louis, Denver, and then as we move into the West Coast areas. But, again, the terminology of pop-ups, the retrofits, the renovations, the rehabs, the infill gutouts where we still maintain the exterior facades and then just gut out the interior, but more predominantly, especially from what we are seeing in, again, whether it be Boston, the New York, Connecticut, Providence areas, Baltimore, D.C. and such, and then certainly in Philly, are the replacement of the traditional Type 3s with Type 5 engineered structural components that either have some facade or some architectural features that mirror the characteristics of the area, or are very explicitly modern construction, and that is becoming very paramount because now we have old school and new school types of tactics within the same block area, and sometimes whether it be the primary fire that you're dealing with that's new construction that has exposures on either end that is old school type 3 construction. So we'll get into some of those additional discussion points and some of those characteristics. Now, recognize this for our listeners, and as Bud just talked about, there are significant variations. And Mike even made a point about this, is that depending upon what region of the country you are listening into, you have in those regions very distinctive features that in some instances are very unique to the region. So although generically we talk about type 3s, and then we talk about some of the things on a local or regional level relative to layout, configurations, the footprint, even the types and species of wood, the timbers that are coming into and being utilized in those structures at the time in which they were built is representative of what the forest and the lumber availability was in those immediate areas. Even the types of materials utilized for the brick, again, are going to be local-based, as well as the third part of that is going to be the vernacular level of workmanship. Who were the builders of those buildings? What type of workmanship and trades did they bring coming across from Europe? And how is that reflected back into the building at a time in which the codes yet were being formalized nationally? We started seeing some consistencies in the early 1900s, but specifically 1915 was sort of that pinnacle year where we had a national code that was available for adoption. But again, a lot of moving parts here when we talk about that. Doug, from your standpoint, what are some of the, and actually I'll just talk about this, what are some of the common recommendations on a very high level that have come out of all four of our reports that we're talking about here? Just a couple of bullet points on some of those.
Well, one of the biggest things is the fire progression that's in there, and the dynamics that have changed with adding fuel loads compared to what they were, especially with, you know, our earlier constructions versus going to the newer style constructions. And one of the things is, stick out, pretty much to me is couple of things that really hit how fast the time progression on this. And some of the contributing factors are these design pictures. You get a pretty good flow that goes through there. That sticks up there. Some of the things is getting that good size. I know we talked about this in some of our programs, is being able to see exactly what you're dealing with from a couple of sides, and row houses are really difficult to do that on, especially if you're middle or whatever, but somebody to that rear side or the roof to be able to tell you what's going on. The other piece that we have to take into consideration here is you can have a lot of hidden fire, especially if it's running this kind of top off or progressing through there, so making sure that you've got a good incident command action plan. Make sure you're using the appropriate tactics and the philosophies, especially if these have been rebuilt into modern engineering construction versus legacy style construction. Again, just looking at some of the just basics that they would go back to bring into operations with communications and actual experience going through this, especially with fireground commanders. But, there's some of the things that are jumping out at me really quick, Chris. I know that there's a ton of things that we can talk about on each one of these specifically that, reach out there. But how fast is it to get in trouble with this? In the South for us, we don't have the style of room houses that you talk about when you go to Philly, when you go to New York, when you're, in more of a Chicagoland area. We just don't have basements here, but that's one of the things that you see in those type of room houses that are very common are the basement areas. And you have fire that you may not be able to see depending on how the construction design is of the foundation, and, be able to walk through the front door and end up into a basement. So those are just some of the things that come out there in my mind for that. And basically making sure or ensuring that fire suppression is initiated on the
core level of the fire whenever possible. And getting that quick water on that fire, as we found from UL studies and NIST studies, that that is very, very critical. And again, being able to have predictability in these buildings, you know, that's important from a tactical perspective. And just some thoughts that I'll throw in there very quickly.
And again, you know, when you talk about predictability of performance, and we've sort of laid that foundation out, again, typically a row house style, both in terms of configuration and layout, is very highly predictable in terms of both the expected performance under fire conditions in a typical fire ground incident and operations. And again, when we take a look at these occupancies, the fire service nationally has an extensive degree of in-depth experience and operational insights over certainly the last couple of hundred years, but certainly over the last 150 years and even more so and more explicitly over the last 100 years. Again, talking about building performance, developing the refinement of strategy and tactics, occupancy risk, the predictability of fire travel, as Mike, as you talked about, in terms of voids that are both vertical and horizontal and such. And then again, as Bud just talked about here, and then as we reinforce, you've got to, for those of you that are in specific areas, whether you are in the Atlantic or Mid-Atlantic or South, Southeast, Mid-Atlantic, Midwest, or again, all the way to the Rockies and to the West Coast, there are very explicit regional-based characteristics based upon how your buildings developed over the last 150-plus years. And based upon, again, materials and more so based upon some of the nuances of layout configuration and footprint. Because, again, you typically are going to have masonry bearing and party walls, some type of masonry front and rear facades. There's typically, just as a result of the terminology that we use, a row house may have some number of adjacent exposures on either side of those bearing or party walls. So again, adjoining occupancy buildings that are part of row houses on either side, which again are going to require and demand additional resources, as well as consideration for proactive fire extension and having resources in place. But commonly, brick and joist, type 3 construction, Mike, as you just talked about, again, wood floor joists, structural supports, plaster and lath, typically narrow types of windows, either sloping or single sloping or modest or modestly oriented type of wood or brick cornices, some type of a stoop that's accessible from the street side, normally some type of a small vestibule, anywhere from 2 to 4 stories in occupiable space. Basements are typically common, or cellars or parlors, again, based upon the kind of configurations. Limited access to those basement areas and limited windows, and then normally smaller footprint of occupiable space relative to our kitchen areas. The bedrooms are normally of a smaller square footages, and more often than not, access through single-run stairs going from the various elevations. And then again, lastly, either the accessible or inaccessible or partial courtyards and some of the rear yards that, again, when we talk about Philly, they're normally going to be inaccessible just because the rear yards from one side of the street to the adjacent, again, those two rear yards butt up against. But again, when we talk about Chicagoland, we have just the opposite, or certainly even when we go to Boston Metro, where we have the alleyways that, again, provide access. So we have front yards, streets on either side of those structures, and then we have a common rear alley that provides accessibility for resources on that 360 all the way around. So just some couple of quick little insights on some of those characteristics. Let me offer this, guys, just real quickly here. So we've talked about these four particular reports. And I'll just provide this. I'll give you some quick insights here on some stats. The Philadelphia report that we're going to talk about here in greater detail, the North Colorado Street, Matt Letourneau, 2018 event. Again, the building vintage, late 1880s to around 1888 was the projected circa of that time frame. Around just under 1,100 square feet, actually 1,038 square feet, two stories with a basement, and again, block to block. So that unit was located within a block setting with streets in front of it on the Alpha Number 1 division, and then bookended by the end of that row, which there were 34 units total, and the unit of fire origination was almost smack in the center, around unit 15 of that location. The other events that we have here, when we talk about the vintage, the Wilmington, Delaware, built 1944, again, 1,075 square feet, two-story structure. The other Philadelphia event in which we lost firefighter EMT Joyce Craig Lewis, built 1925, 1,300 square feet, two stories. And then lastly, the Baltimore City event of 2014 November, 1920s, two-story, 1,500 square feet. So we can see that there's some commonalities here in terms of vintages, of which the North Colorado Street event was the one of the oldest relative to that. Now, there are other structures here. Now, we talk about row houses. There are other buildings that incidents have occurred relative to type 3s. And, Mike, you and I were talking about couple of events in Boston. But, again, the thing our listeners need to distinguish is that there's a difference between row frame, row house, graystones, brownstones, walk-ups, and such. So terminology is very important for our listeners to differentiate between what those building types are, what they mean, what they represent, construction, materials, and so forth. So there's a lot more to this than one may initially recognize, and a lot more that if you're not even familiar with what we're getting into and talking about, there's a lot more to it. So again, I just wanted to put that out there real quickly. So let's talk a little bit more about Philadelphia and some of the details in that. And again, you guys can jump into it. What I'm going to do here is just paint a little bit of a background specific to the initial documents. So in Philadelphia, the what's called the North Colorado Street fire, again, that occurred on January 6th of 2018, there's actually three reports. So again, another takeaway for our listeners is this, is that there are explicitly, when we talk about row house firefighting and the true depth of learnings and lessons, the two reports that should be on every fire officer and commander's radar screen, and if you haven't read these reports, then shame on you, but take this as a learning and a prompt to start reading these things. The two specific reports that should be on your reading list to gain some current insights are certainly the NIOSH report that we've referenced here of this event on the North Colorado Street fire in Philadelphia, and then also the NIOSH report from 2016 dealing with the Wilmington, Delaware fire. So there are some common elements here in both events. Both resulted in collapses, one dealing with a floor collapse of the number two floor into the number one occupiable space, which was the Letourneau event, and then the Wilmington, Delaware fire was actually a floor collapse resulting of personnel, again, in the basement area. But, again, building performance, challenging operational issues, the immediacy of what transpired in Philadelphia, when we take a look at that timeline, again, these are during the initial stages of our operations. But in each event, and in all events, there's also the exposure issues of environmental factors. So we'll talk a little bit more about that, but I'm going to allow you to get into that here in a moment. But so the first report that came out of Philly was the after-action report. And the after-action report was the internal report that the City of Philadelphia Fire Department initiated to start the process of identifying the lessons and learnings and identifying the attributes of what resulted in a certainly an undesirable set of circumstances resulted in the line of duty death of a firefighter. And again, for any of our listeners that have gone through line of duty death event reporting, the investigations, or even near miss or significant events. So there's significant event reports, after action reports, near miss reports. These are all of varying levels of intensity and such, but certainly we can't say enough about the level of quality and detail and depth that the after action review represented, both in terms of looking at all of the elements and identifying features and conditions and information that would help the firefighting force in the city, the commanders, the firefighters, the citizens, and then more importantly, the lessons that came out of that report that were also instituted in the NIOSH report. So the Philly report actually has three dovetailed reports. It has the after-action report that was under the guidance of Deputy Chief Vincent Mulray and his staff, as well as the technical review committee at the executive level and the operational level within Philadelphia, again, all under the leadership and guidance of Chief Adam Teal. The second report, which was actually the third last report, so the after-action report came first. In conjunction with that after-action report, I had the opportunity actually to work on providing some insights on building performance during the fire operations dealing with this residential row house building and the subsequent collapse, primarily as a technical advisor and subject matter expert to the City of Philadelphia Fire Department. So that insight and report is a standalone report that is embedded in both the Philly after action report and explicitly referenced in the NIOSH report. So the NIOSH report has a wealth of information on building performance and operational insights, some of which that we'll try to talk about here on our program, but again, time limitations may limit us. But there's a wealth of information in all three of those documents that will provide you, the listener, at the command or company level, key insights to help you tactically or strategically. For those of you that are instructors or are in safety officer capacities, again, a wealth of lessons and learnings and recommendations that come out of those three reports. The NIOSH report does have quite a bit of detail on the building characteristics that we'll talk a little bit further about, but again, just to give you some insights on that. So let me give our listeners just a quick sort of overview on a couple of items here, and then, Bud, I want you to sort of talk a little bit more about some of the particulars of that event, if you would, and then
sure.
And then we'll have both Doug and Mike provide some additional insights. So this event occurred during some very challenging weather conditions in the early morning hours of January 6th, 2018. And again, the fire occurred about midpoint of the street area of 34 units that extended from one end to the other end of that city block area. Matt Letourneau, who was the lieutenant on the engine company first arriving, 42 years of age, 11-year veteran of the City of Philadelphia Fire Department, again, became trapped as a result of an interior structural collapse while engaging in interior firefighting operations. And again, initial reports were that there was an individual trapped or reported of being trapped in that building. That information was coming from surrounding occupants who knew of that individual and, again, recognized this, that one of the important takeaways in this building was that the building looked one way on street side, but in actuality what kinds of conditions the fire department was encountering internal to the operations was vastly different. So we even talked about that a few moments ago relative to what we may be seeing and sizing up at street side may not be indicative of what you're expecting to find on the inside. So there's a couple of items there, but during the conduct of operations, again, a civilian was pulled out of that structure who did not survive. Again, he was removed during the initial stages of initial fire attack, in which, again, a number of different activities were occurring, both some adaptive options were being utilized of a transitional attack, or providing water from the exterior to the interior at different stages that all supported the very aggressive interior posturing of placing firefighters within the structure for both suppression as well as the assignment of search and rescue. So very early in the stages of the operation, the floor area on the number two floor catastrophically failed, and it failed in a perfect V-shaped collapse based upon the 15-foot span between the two party walls that were present, resulting in the entrapment of Lieutenant Matt Letourneau. Some of the contributing factors very quickly here included extreme cold weather, water supply issues relative to inoperable hydrants, inherent building characteristics that were very unique to the row house configurations and the variations that were particularly present here, structural overloading, excessive clutter, and deteriorated building conditions. So what was not obvious on the outside was that we had a building interiorly that had very deteriorated conditions, which actually had no heat or electrical service to that, that is not typically recognized, but is very typical of many dense urban environments out there. Many of our listeners, again, have experienced these kinds of conditions and so forth. So the roof actually had deteriorated, and there was vegetation growing from within the structure through the roof area. It was open to the elements, again, 365 days of the year, limited types of heating support within the structure. So whatever support from a heating device, whether it be an open burning fire within some type of device or the fireplace, was present. So that those are elements to consider. But again, the other clear takeaway here is the excessive clutter that was present and the heavy content loading. Risk assessment issues dealing with structural integrity during various phases of the structure based upon fire severity and its effect on the building materials and fire extension. And then some of the key takeaways here I'll actually refrain to for a moment going forward. So, but give us some quick insights that you're familiar with regarding some of the operational aspects.
Well, I kind of got into the game a little bit late when I got the phone call about Matt. He had already been pulled from the rubble and had been taken to the hospital. I just had known that he had passed. The other thing too was I had talked to a few guys on his platoon who are still with Engine 45, in fact. And the way the rows are set up is, usually there's a staircase to the left or to the right, usually located in front of the door. When you come in the door, there's a set of stairs that go right to the second floor. And the majority of the living space is off to your right or left. And it was just so happened that I'm to tell you who exactly went in, but they got to the top of the steps, and they had heavy fire conditions, and the floor gave way at that point. And a couple of guys rode the floor down, not knowing that Matt was underneath it. This is what I learned later on, probably maybe you for 3 year interviews and all that, that you found that out. Yes, it was hoarding conditions were terrible. It was your worst case scenario, really. It was the house had been neglected for many years. They were living in squalor. Of course, Matt was just doing his job. They did, there was a deceased person that was right out front. Then they went back in again because of a report of, there was another trapped victim inside. And, of course, Matt, that's what he hears, and he's in there. And then the floor obviously gave way. And I guess you want to talk about the failure point of what it was, what actually was helped to cause that floor to actually V-shape itself and drop in, to the would-be probably the dining room area. It had been compromised by an old, I believe it was a gas pipe. Is that correct,
Chris? That is correct, yeah. Yeah, that's, yeah, again, yeah. That's some of the insights where you know, you may not recognize some of the things that you may be very well seeing. And again, we're talking about companies out there. You may be seeing some things that commonly are exposed during overhaul stages or other things that are evident, but you may not be connecting what it is that you're seeing, the importance of that observation, with what it's potentially telling us. So in this instance, as you mentioned, the gas line service was introduced at some point in the late 1800s. So prior to that, there was no electricity. Gas service was now being made available to the various areas throughout the city. And what they ended up doing was, in order to bring that service and piping in from the street, they brought it in through a connection point on the number one division, street side division, and they brought it in and up into the voided space of the number two floor. So instead of penetrating the plaster and lath underneath it, which would be in the dining room or living room areas, they ended up bringing up the floorboards on the number two floor, and in order to allow that to be placed within the confined of those channels and spaces in between the floor joists, they ended up notching out a small notch in the top of the wooden joist at its most potentially weakest point, or certainly the point in which it could cause the biggest harm down the road. So center point of the span, if we have a 15-foot span, approximately 7.5 feet from one wall to the other, they cut this notch, each and every joist going from front to the rear of the structure, and they laid that cast iron pipe within that. So what ended up happening here as a result of age and deterioration and loss of moisture content, coupled with the fact that this particular species of wood was highly susceptible toward to collapse. In other words, I mentioned earlier on a lot of the vernacular elements, the kinds of materials that one typically finds in your buildings and in some of your areas. Again, they ended up taking the worst type of wood and utilized that for those floor joists. So what caused the fire department to sort of start questioning a number of things in a very common type of fire that certainly the Philadelphia Fire Department has fought hundreds of thousands of fires within these types of buildings and occupancies. This became that perfect storm on that particular time and event. So those notches as a contributor to the heavy content loading, as well as both water, as well as the debris that was in there, structural deficiencies, and all these other factors, as the compression and tension was being imposed on those floor joists, the top was compressing, the bottom was pulling away, and we have a failure point that as that failure point started occurring, we have a perfect V-shaped collapse that occurred right along that center line. And unfortunately, again, the tip man and Matt were present within that occupiable space, and Matt caught the brunt of it within the within that V-shaped collapse. So commonly, our listeners should be familiar with the fact that, especially with floor failures or compromises, you can have a partial compromise or a more substantial collapse, but it's going to be limited to some type of a lean-to or partial failure of a floor diaphragm coming out of a pocketed wall. But we typically don't see pancake collapses within, you know, readily kept structures unless there's a blowout of a end wall unit or some type of failure in multiple occupancies. So it's normally going to be some type of an isolated lean-to collapse, but this was a very highly unusual and the only documented event that I've ever heard of in my 40-plus years, as well as research, where we have a very explicit failure point right smack in the middle.
One thing I'd like to add, Chris, and this is to everybody who's listening, don't discount the fact that old gas lighting lines are abandoned, meaning that there are still some that are still active. We've run across maybe one or two, not a whole lot, but the age of that house would be right around the time of electrification. And a lot of times electricians use the old gas piping to run their wires through. I found that out myself here in my own local. So don't discount the fact that the pipe doesn't contain gas at some point. It still could be active. And you're right. One thing I do teach about in class, and this applies to row homes and older homes of that style and of that age, especially when they started doing wet bed tile and wet bed floors, meaning that it's a cement base with a skin of cement over it, and you put your tile down. Just from reference from all the ones that I've worked on over the years, an average wet bed tile bathroom, the tile itself weighs about 5,000 pounds. And a cast iron tub is running anywhere from 350 to 400. So what I'm trying to say, and what I try to convey to my class, obviously if you're overhauling and you notice, there's a lot of charring around your soil pipes and all that, do me a favor, don't stand under it because it just might cut loose. It happened to a friend of mine that I know. The floor did cut loose. The cast iron tub came down out of the second floor and caught him in the shoulder. And he was off the job for about 4 months. So those are the areas that will always be compromised, only because of your size of your soil pipes and the size of the framing members of the time period. Sometimes people don't understand. You take a 2x10 and take a 4-inch notch out of it, you don't have a 2x10 anymore. You know, so that's why I warn our guys, you know, that I teach to say, you know, please, stay out from underneath the bathroom, especially if it's the old wet bed tile. It's a tremendous amount of weight in a very compressed area like your hall bathroom would be. Yeah.
Absolutely. I've got we've got a listener that we've got a call in, and it's coming from the Philly metro area. So who do we have on the line here that's called in?
Hi, Chris. It's Vince Mulray.
Hi, Chief. Oh my gosh, it's such a pleasure,
Chief,
to have you call in. It's great to hear you. So thank you very much. So we've got Chief Mulray.
I made sure I tagged Vince that we were going to be on tonight.
Also, hello to Bud, Mike, and Doug.
Yeah, there you
that
go.
Is, well, thank you very much. As you may have been listening, I'm presuming you've been listening in, we're trying to connect a number of dots here in a very high level of discussion with some degree of focus, which we obviously don't have the time allotment to get into a lot of details, but we're trying to connect a number of different elements here that are affecting certainly the American Fire Service with some adverse trends with both near misses as well as the line of duty deaths, and certainly the exceptional work that that you did and your team, representative of the City of Philadelphia, in honor of Matt's passing, with the both the after action report and as well as the NIOSH report out there. So let me just mention this, and Vince, I'm going to turn it over to you to provide some commentary from a firsthand standpoint. One of the things that we're talking about here is from the Wood Joy standpoint. Again, this is sort of that circa 1880 standpoint. The material itself that, or the species of wood, was eastern hemlock. And one of the things that was a precipitator to further insights that NIOSH also provided some accurate depictions on was the fact that as the investigation started, really from day one, especially with the activities tactically of debris removal, was the fact that as structural elements were being removed, it was clearly and early identified that this wood was very, very light. And, Chief, I remember you and I having the conversation very early on that the depiction of that and characteristics of that wood was almost like it was balsa wood type. It was just such a it lacked density. It lacked any type of weight that one would expect to find. And what we ended up discovering through two levels of research, one was the clear identification through NIOSH of the species, which was identified as eastern hemlock, and then we found that eastern hemlock, based upon research in some of the books that were being published in the late 1800s, early 1900s, in some of the construction books in that early days, it clearly identified that eastern hemlock was not a preferred species of wood that would be utilized for wood joists, but what would be typically found for scabbing material, or more importantly, the lathing material for the structure. So the typical issues as we have with builders out there, it was much easier to take these trees, which turned out to be eastern hemlock, within the fringes of the city as the city proper was expanding outward and these trees were being removed. Guess what? They were eastern hemlock was the predominant species. The better woods were further out, so the builders took the cheap wood, utilized them internally, and this is what we've got existing out there today. So it has a significant weakness. It moderately is weak in both bending strength and, again, compression issues. It does have a very low splitting resistance, which was clearly identified in terms of how that floor failed from front division, from the front side of the building, going inward to the structure, and eventually catastrophically failed along that center line. So just some of the clear, you know, sort of nuts and bolts of it that's, again, further expanded upon in both the after-action report as well as the NIOSH report. So, Chief Mulray, why don't you, if you would, and if you're so inclined, I don't want to put you on the spot, can you provide some insights on a high-level, sort of an executive-level insights, both maybe from the operational end, a couple of key takeaways, and then some of the takeaways regarding the recommendations that came out of the report?
Look, Chris, I just want to say, first of all, you know, we identified 9 contributing factors that we feel led to this collapse. And the notch in the wood was one of them, but it was only one of 9. You know, there was crew integrity, water supply, extreme weather, and a host of other things. Can you still hear me?
Yes, you're coming across.
Okay.
There.
All right. Speaking of the notch, first of all, the notch was put in when the building was first built. The building was built in 1888, we believe, and that was before electricity was serviced on that block. So as they were building this house, that one-inch gas pipe was notched into the floor joists in order to provide lighting to a couple key rooms in that house. It was the early 1900s that that area received electricity, and then electricity was installed in those houses. So I just want to say that notch was part of the original house. We found that notch in other houses throughout the neighborhood a little further north, and it was very consistent of that time period. A little later, they did away with that, and they ran all electric into the houses. So that was one of the key parts. A little bit about the lessons learned, and one of the other contributing factors, we talked about time discipline. And one of the things that we have in Philadelphia is the 20-minute rule, where the communications will announce that, you know, the amount of time that we've been in service on the fire ground. And we found out through this fire that it was communicated from the dispatch to the communications vehicle, but it was not passed on, or we could not confirm if it was actually passed on to the incident commander. And that was only one time. And we noticed this fire ground went for approximately 42 minutes before we had a catastrophic collapse. What was your other question, Chris? There was another one?
No, actually, you're just going right along with it. So, again, some of the challenges operationally, both from command leading up to the collapse, but, again, I think some of the insights for our listeners are really important relative to the contributing factors and the lessons. So let me ask you this, Chief. What were some of the implemented takeaways as a result, the early implemented items as well as those that are being planned, as far as the lessons and the recommendations that are going to be instituted in Philadelphia?
I think one of the biggest things is going to be a building construction course. And, you know, we've gone over fire ground survival, incident command, and now we're headed into another realm through our training division, which is going to address the building construction. The one conception I want to mention, though, is I worked in this neighborhood for approximately the last 30, 35 years. And when I first went to that part of lower North Philadelphia, we always assumed that the houses were approximately 100 years old. The problem is I've worked there for the last 30 years, and now this particular house was 130 years old. And not a whole lot was done to that house in the 30 years that I've worked in that neighborhood. That, you know, one thing you have to realize, you talked about the number of vacant houses in Philadelphia. You also have to remember that 25 to 30% of the population is living below the poverty level. And that particular street, like you said, these row houses, they put on a very good front because fronts were normally kept up a little better. The bricks were a little tighter, but when you went to the rear of the properties, they were usually the area where they used more wood. It's the area that would have been less maintained, and that was exactly what this property showed. And almost every property in this neighborhood shows the same thing.
So there's consistency, again, based upon local battalions and divisional areas and such, that really it's incumbent upon our officers that are listening in to have a clear understanding of the social economical issues that are stressors within their first due, and then how that may relate back to building conditions and expected conditions that one would encounter during an incident operation.
Absolutely. And Chris, there's one other thing I know you mentioned on the operational considerations, and one thing was the weather and how that snowballed, so to speak, into other things. At the time of fire, it was 9 degrees out that day. There was snow on the ground. With the wind chill, it was about 10 degrees below zero. We had about a 20-mile-an-hour wind, with wind gusts anywhere between 30 and 40 miles an hour on that particular day. So with that, we had a number of water supply issues where a pump operator would attempt to, you know, get a water supply, and he'd have to go to two or three hydrants until we found one that was operational. And what that did is that slowed down the fire ground in the beginning. One of the other things that this weather did was there's a little piece in our after action review that talks about the white smoke, how from an incident command standpoint, the color of the smoke was disguised because of the low temperature. When the temperature is below 10 degrees, the smoke tends to be white, and it masks itself. And when we look at the color of the smoke, we should really be looking more at the density, because density trumps volume. And it's just one of the things that we identified out of there. A second or a third operational thing that we discovered was the air supply. We had three or four firefighters from one team going in at the same time, but they were running out of air at different times. And what it did is it disrupted our crew integrity a little bit. So that was another minor contributing factor that led to challenges on the fire ground.
And again, would it be safe to say that this was in the earliest stages of this operation, it was considered a bread and butter operation?
Absolutely. And if we did have a little bit of video of this fire, and it was Matt's orders were 3 inch to the bag, and it was very standard to stretch a 3 inch supply line down the street, 4, 5, 6 lengths connected to the pumper. Have a second in bag is what they call it, with a bag already pre-connected with 3 lengths of 1 3/4 with a gated Y that would hook right up to it. And then it would have that 3 lengths would be adequate for most of those houses down there, especially a 2-story. And, you know, from the front door, that water line, you know, theoretically could have hit the back door because the house just wasn't that deep.
And that's pretty typical of when we talk about row houses and the footprints and the square footages and the volumes and spaces. These buildings are not significantly large or complex. We have developed tactics that are pretty common amongst the American Fire Service that, again, especially within the urbanized metro-type settings, that have been proven by decades worth of improvements and developing those skill sets. So what I'm getting at here, and the reason I wanted you to confirm that, as we know, is that these building types, for many of our listeners that have them, don't get complacent. You know, there are going to be variables and challenges that are going to be imposed upon companies as they go through the initial stages of an evolving incident, both strategically and then in that tactical standpoint of the initial arriving company. So, you know, additional intel relative to building. We identified a number of attributes regarding some correlating factors. In other words, if one finds clutter in the structure or heavy content loading, could that and should that be a trigger point for command to possibly consider the implications of that observation or of that communication? So there's going to be a variety of things that one would communicate, identify what's the relevancy and the importance of that information, both at the tactical and at the command level. And that very well may change your perspective of what you're doing in the street. So, you know, certainly the challenges were right from the get-go, where you've got report of entrapment, you've got weather conditions, you're following normal process procedures and protocols that have been proven. They're very well established and expected by companies, but then we find that the buildings, you know, characteristics construction-wise, as well as the other inherent factors of heavy content loading, dereliction of construction features, maintenance, and so forth, suddenly you have these series of dominoes that are all falling that suddenly may create a potential perfect storm of an undesirable outcome. So, again, Chief, I want to commend the efforts, and I certainly want to personally thank you publicly for the opportunity to help support the Philadelphia Fire Department, certainly to help identify the things that we collectively were able to put together in both the after-action report and then subsequently into the NIOSH report, that certainly will go a long way to help the not only the American but the North American Fire Service regarding these building types and maybe some suggested areas of improvement that might be present within any jurisdiction around the United States.
Thank you, Chris. And you know, it wasn't just me. You know, my team consisted of four other people for the after action review team, plus the peer review committee, which was instrumental in helping us get this report out, along with NIOSH's help and your help, and many others that are some of them are listed in the report.
That collective ensemble of resources was exceptional, and again, the after action review team, both the two captains, lieutenants, and the technical review committee that provided the support. This was it's safe to say a very involving process that took a considerable amount of time to get it right, and that's commendable for any organization, but certainly for your leadership and certainly the leadership under the commissioner and what was put out by both NIOSH and the fire department. So, again, thank you.
Absolutely.
Very much. Thank you very much. We're sort of getting into that time frame where, as we're starting to whittle down, we're almost 90 minutes into our session, and we certainly could be talking about a lot of elements. We just started scratching the surface into a variety of different areas. I actually had both Mike Lapina and Doug Klein were ready to provide some insights on two reports, the Wilmington, Delaware report, and as well as the Baltimore, Maryland report. Guys, I'm going to sort of have you hold off on that. I want to sort of end our discussion talking about some of the upcoming challenges regarding the evolution of the row house within our various response areas that, again, may be a stepping stone for our next podcast or conversation. Bear with me a quick moment here. Slight tickle in my throat. So again, we our intent was to cover some more information to provide some continuity. The continuity dealing with the Baltimore, Maryland line of duty death, but more importantly, the connotations and the connections of the Wilmington, Delaware floor collapse, because there are some contributors and some other insights on building performance, operational items, the elements here of, again, that support tactical decision-making or tactical operations and command decision-making. So we very well may utilize this as a stepping stone. I'll ask you guys this. What I may do, I'm not sure what our next scheduled night may be for our Buildings on Fire. I think we're coming up to the end of the year. I'm not sure if we've got something. If we do have something scheduled in December, and I'll check on that, we will have part two of our discussion on insights of row houses during the month of December. And if not December, we'll move that into our next presentation in the month of January. But I'm also thinking also that this would make for a very well-rounded opportunity maybe to do a Zoom program. So we'll take advantage of what we've laid the groundwork on. We can utilize some visuals and help support our podcast presentation here with a webinar on some additional insights on row house construction, operation safety, and recommendations that have come out of our NIOSH report. So if you guys are in on that, which I'm sure you will be, we'll take a look at that for our listeners, and we'll get some stuff out on social media. So what I'd like to do is sort of start ending our program here, going back to the emerging issues of the new row house. And that new row house, again, Chief, you certainly are familiar with what's occurring within Philadelphia regarding the changing characteristics and composition of block areas that now have single or multiple unit new constructed row house type structures that are either embedded in between old stuff or are now taking the place of old with new. So I'll ask all three of you to, or actually all four of you, to give us some insights on some of this emerging issues, the pop-ups that are very common, certainly in Baltimore, as well as the, and they may very well have originated in Philadelphia now that I think about it, because when we talk about old days, you know, what better and only place could anyone who owned their row house do any kind of changes, and that was at the roof line and creating either additional occupiable space or recreational space on those roofs. And again, you can go to any area or neighborhood in Philly and see what some of these, this term pop-up may be. But the true pop-ups as they originated in Washington, D.C., where they literally take the top floor or the roof off and pop it and literally add on a floor or two going upwards. So you have traditional type 3, heritage, legacy construction on the lower floors, and you more likely will have engineered construction of one or more floors up above going vertically. So we are seeing that kind of condition, as well as the renovations, the retrofits, the infill construction where you have facades that identify what appears to be, when you read the building and size it up, what appears to be an inherent common old type of row house on the facade at street side, but in actuality the interior has been gutted out. The original fully dimensioned lumber have been removed, and we now find engineered materials and so forth. So I'll ask all three of you, and we'll start, actually we'll start with Chief Mulray, if he's still on. From your perspective, from a command perspective, what are some of the upcoming challenges that the city of Philadelphia may be experiencing from a suppression and command standpoint with this new emerging construction type of new row houses?
Chris, the one thing that really stands out when I think about the new row houses are how tightly that they're built. I want to let Bud talk a little bit about the construction that's under them, but when we find these fires with the room and contents, we find that they don't show themselves readily from the outside. And it's not till you actually, you know, have to investigate, you go in and you find that closed door for the middle bedroom that you find out you have a fully involved room. A lot of times, because of the new windows, that the tighter sheetrock where all the joints are taped and there's very few seams and it's all energy efficient, a lot of these fires today from a operations and tactical standpoint, are they don't show themselves readily from the outside. And it's almost like they lure us in, where an older legacy-type property would have a lot more voids, would have a lot more ways for the smoke to get out, where these newer ones kind of lure us in a little bit.
That's about right, Vince. You know, the thing is that you're exactly right. It's what they're introducing more update materials, like you said, insulated windows, things like that. Back the old rows, you know, you're used to walking into 30 years ago. Obviously, the codes weren't the same as they are today. I mean, we have to do an incredible amount of fire stopping around any type of vertical, you know, or horizontal shafts, whatever. And you're right, there was a little bit of breathing room in the row house. We have the same thing here in Ambler, where, you know, where I live. The ones that are renovated, they do seem to be obviously tighter. But that's a really good point. I mean, it's just not the same. And when I teach the guys in Philly, I said, you know, it isn't the same row house you're walking into. The number one and the number one thing to remember, the most important thing that all this lightweight construction has taken out of our toolbox is our most important tool, which is time. You know, time to get in the knee what we have to do and get out. It's called loitering time. And that has been, you know, cut dramatically. And I get the guys in class ask me, well, how do we know? How do we know what we're walking into? Well, you don't. This is the time to start investigating. Cut a hole in the floor. See what you have. You have TGIs, you have parallel cord, whatever. Now you know what you're getting into. You don't have to get all the way into the middle of the building and realize that, uh-oh, hold on. You know, the floor is feeling spongy, and then the next thing you know, it goes. You know, so we have to be more proactive today, whether it be in Philly, Baltimore, wherever, with these renovated rows, to better understand what kind of time frame we have to work, you know, for sure.
Yeah, no question about that. Fundamental to everything that we do. Mike, how's your perspective on the emerging issues with the newer construction and the new emerging row house?
Well, certainly the lightweight component factors into that. Just looking, if you had not told me that that this was a legacy built house, albeit with very poor quality timber, looking at the photo that's on the executive summary portion of the report, I would have said right away, oh, that looks like it was an open web or a parallel core truss that was in this house. It was a remodeled house. Just based on the V collapse, it would be suggestive that went away. So the collapse potential is very similar, I think, to what we see nowadays. But to the point of opening up as you go in, that's absolutely paramount because you don't know what you're going into unless you physically saw that building being rehabbed with the open webs or TJIs or whatever. We have to do that initial inspection when we go in to see what we have, and certainly adjust our tactics accordingly. And I think that's being realized. But one of the things that stands up about these four fires that we looked at tonight, or we were going to look at, is that they're all in old legacy constructed buildings. They're not lightweight, and yet they still resulted in line of duty deaths of firefighters. So we put an emphasis on the lightweight. But we also have to remember that the older style constructions have their faults as well, and certainly be very cognizant of what we're going into and being able to identify that.
That's a great comment because, again, we put so much emphasis in so many other areas, but it goes back to the fundamentals, understanding construction, understanding the occupancy, understanding the nuances of what may be local or regionally based, and then utilizing an adaptive perspective, being somewhat conservative, bias-based. In other words, be cautious but still maintain a level of readiness and aggressiveness to that posture. Chief Klein, any closing comments on the issues of construction?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to really take advantage of our opportunities to be out into the streets. And also, if you get a chance to get into these buildings, especially on medical calls that we run so many of today, and, you know, as part of what you begin building your strategy and your tactics and your incident action plans, opening up has already been said, but that is very, very critical. The other part I want folks to think about is that these buildings may not be completely redone. They may only be partially redone with areas that are weakened. So you could have a very strong hybrid system of legacy-style construction mixed with engineering-style construction, or you could take the legacy construction and have cosmetic changes to it where your lath and plaster, which is still over a balloon frame-style construction, is now got sheetrock, and you know that does change the dimensions. We've added those windows that are energy efficient, those type of things. So part of what we really got to be doing is getting first arriving company officers and our first arriving incident command level officers, getting a true risk assessment and a good detailed size up. And that communication back and forth between the officer that's going in and the command officer and decision making that's going off is critical, and that's part of the size up. And again, you know, really understanding the building that you're in. And last but not least, I want to throw out there that you still have what is probably going to be like a basement or something underneath there that you could have a lot of hidden fire that you know nothing about that could really impact. And, you know, opening that floor up, you know, seeing some of the things that you have, or even, you know, being very proactive and watching what's going on construction-wise is critical.
Great answer. I love the connotations of the hybrid in this kind of capacity. We've traditionally been talking about hybrid construction, which relates back to conventional and engineered components in both commercial, predominantly commercial-based occupancies in the last number of years. But it's refreshing that we suddenly are talking about the hybrid of both new and traditional legacy construction in a building type that's always been considered to predominantly be old school, traditional based, legacy, heritage, whatever the term one wants to use. So some great insights, guys. I certainly want to thank our guests for their contributions. We've gone through a very, very short span of time talking about a lot of different things within that context with the opportunity to talk a lot about much, much more. So we will certainly take a look at setting up a schedule for part two of our insights on row house construction, and we'll take a look at that next available date as well as some other opportunities. So, again, thank you for you, the listeners that are tuning in. For those of you that are looking for some additional insights and information, please feel free to email me. Email address is in a variety of different cases on social media, on our Facebook page, our Twitter page, on our web pages and blogs and so forth. Please send me a quick note. We'll tie you into the various reports, either directly or we will send you those reports if you're not able to obtain those, both from the NIOSH site, the After Action Report from Philadelphia that's available online, as well as other references that we've made reference to. And I'm sure that, again, our guests would be more than happy to provide some additional insights to you as well, both from Chief Klein, Chief Mulray, Bud Henkels, Mike Lapina. Again, we're all here to help support the mission of safety on the fire ground while maintaining an aggressive posture to do what we need to do to serve our citizens. So thank you all again.
Absolutely.
Until next time, companies are in quarters and off the air. Stay safe, but keep in mind there's a job being worked somewhere in the streets in your city, across the country and around the world, doing what we do best and being who we are, and that's firefighters. Take care, everybody. Until next time, Chris Nomes signing off. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks,
have
Chris.
A good evening.
Thank you. Good night.